Hello and welcome back to Impact Factor. I am your host, Katie Van Aken, and this week I had the pleasure of interviewing Diana Perry, who is almost done. She is defending in a few weeks, and she was nice enough to give us her time to tell us about her experience pursuing the studies of fishery sciences. And I learned so much, and I hope you do too. It was a fascinating conversation. And here you go. Let's start from the beginning. So undergrad, talk to me about your undergrad. What were your academic pursuits?
I was a chemistry major with a biochemistry concentration and an environmental studies minor because no one does one thing at Haverford.
No, very true.
Yeah, so I came in pretty heavy knowing that I was going to be a chemistry major. I really, really wanted to do ocean acidification and coral research.
Can you back up? What was that word?
Ocean acidification.
Oh, okay. Two words.
Yeah, sorry. I said it very fast.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
So basically, as our climate is warming and CO2 is going into the atmosphere, it's mixing with the ocean and the ocean is becoming more acidic. And killing corals along with other wonderful sea creatures. So I really, really wanted to do that going into undergrad. Throughout my undergrad experience, I actually managed to get an NSFRU. It's a National Science Foundation Research Experience for Undergraduates summer internship. And I worked at Moat Marine Laboratories down in Sarasota, Florida. There I did some basically soil/sediment chemistry, looking at chlorophyll A content, because Florida has a ton of different deposits of a bunch of different minerals and basically different compounds that you would see throughout the state. And so that lab was working, I think, with, it was either USGS or EPA, but a larger federal agency to sort of do a survey of the state of Florida, and I'm sure they were doing other states as well. But I did that and basically did a very simple, how do we do a statistical analysis of various different sediment types to actually get a true reading of what the chlorophyll A content is across sediment types. So I analyzed something close to like 300 samples, I think, of chlorophyll A, and then did a bunch of different statistical analyses to figure out what grouping, like, is it five different separate samples? Is it like two samples where you've mixed three samples in each? Things like that. So like what grouping of samples might give us the best estimate of the chlorophyll A content according to basically the sediment size. So did that. I think I did it.
Wait, I have a question. Yes. About that. Did you experience field work or were you really just like in a lab?
So I actually did my own field work. I worked with my mentor and we decided on like, I think, three different sites that we were anticipating to have different sediment sizes. And so I did my own field work. They were all relatively close to the laboratory and I was lucky enough to have a car so I could, for the like two sites that were slightly further away, I was able to drive. And so, yeah, so that was, I guess, technically my only field work in science to date, which is sort of sad, but I love being
outside.
But it's
so important that you had that experience because all the research you're doing is things taken from the outdoors and like, you know, that's good.
Yeah. So yeah, so I did that. I think I did that after my sophomore year at Haverford, actually. And then I ended up working with Karin Ockerfeld. I think you interviewed Jamie Denizio a couple weeks ago, yeah. And she was working with Karin. So I worked with Karin, and she actually was very kind and very supportive and allowed me to sort of start a new project with her and her sort of counterpart in Sweden, because she had a PhD student in Lund who was doing a little more sort of nanotoxicology, environmental chemistry, and I was more interested in the environmental stuff than the standard like protein structure that she was doing, Karin was doing in her lab. So yeah, so my undergrad thesis was basically figuring out a way to actually create gold nanoparticles of particular sizes, and then I tested them on Daphnia magna, which is a basically water flea that's used pretty commonly in water toxicology studies, or nanotoxicology studies, excuse me. So basically we were testing, my chemistry thesis was like some portion very focused on chemistry, but also had a little bit more of a biochemistry tinge to it as well. So that was my undergrad thesis. Parts of that got published as part of that person's dissertation. So that was actually my first authored publication.
Cool.
And yeah, so then I ended up taking a year off and went back to get my master's at the University of Washington in Seattle. And so I was there for 2 years getting my master's, technically a master's of marine affairs. My thesis, because I realized, sorry, going back for a second, I realized during my time actually at the REU and through various experiences at Haverford and various other academic institutions, I was probably not destined for academia. I really do not enjoy writing, and the thought of having to chase money all the time did not hold any appeal to me, and still doesn't. That is not, I was actually just talking with my friends about this. I can't speak for them. I like most of the other aspects of academia. I love the freedom to pursue what you would like. In terms of research, I love the aspect of discovery and like really trying to understand things. And I love the flexibility that you have. If you have something that's going on in your life, you can sort of put things on hold for a particular hour or a couple days or whatever, and you can go back and sort of use other time to get back on track. So I love those aspects of academia, but honestly, the administrative red tape that comes along with much of academia, as well as the constant chasing after grants, is not particularly appealing, we'll put it that way. So after Haverford and various other experiences, particularly the other experiences, I was like, academia is probably not for me, but I am still super interested in sort of the marine policy space, because as I went through Haverford and as I was sort of living in the world, and this goes back to the ocean acidification and coral research that I came into Haverford with, I really wanted to see science applied into policy. And how were we applying the best available science, because people love saying that, best available science, and actually molding our policy around that. So I wanted to transition a little bit more away from chemistry, but in my academic realm, and learn much more about how do we mold our policy on our, specifically our marine resources. How do we manage those, given what we know about either the resource or the ecosystem, or people often forget, and this is becoming more common, but the people who depend on these fish, whether in the U.S. it's typically commercial fisheries that people care, like politicians care about, because they bring in billions of dollars every year, but there's also people that subsistence fish. How do we make sure that this resource is there for the years to come that depend on this resource to eat and live?
Interesting.
So made that transition, or still making that transition, I guess, and went to get my master's at UW. My thesis there was focused on how management decisions following the large 2015 harmful algal bloom in California, how those management decisions to open and close particular areas of the California coast affected the Dungeness crab fishery. So in the Dungeness crab fishery in California, they have vessels that are much smaller, and then they have vessels that are much larger. And so I specifically looked at how those opening and closings along the coasts affected basically the economic output of those vessels. So basically the conclusions there were, by opening and closing in a way that wasn't really anticipated, because the management choices there were much different than previous years, it was to the benefit of the larger vessels. They were able to travel up and down the coasts as these areas opened, whereas the smaller vessels were sort of stuck where travel distance-wise, where their home ports were. And so that research actually got published, I think, in 2019, maybe 2020, I can't remember. And after that, sorry, this is going on for a while. after it's that, okay. I managed to get a Sea Grant Fellowship in Alaska. So I was a Alaska State Sea Grant Fellow, graduate fellow with NOAA. I worked with NOAA's, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, their lab in Auk Bay in Juneau, Alaska. So I was up there for a year, and I worked on scallop aquaculture. Specifically, they have, and if you know the map of Alaska at all, or even can just think about it, there's a large portion of the southeastern corridor that is vast majority islands and a ton of coastline. And so if you look at that map of Alaska, you can understand how there are sort of somewhat inshore, or at least protected waters that could be used for aquaculture. And up there, it's generally called mariculture. And so there are a number of different oystermen there, and throughout Alaska. But NOAA specifically was trying to see if a particular type of scallop could potentially be reared as an aquaculture species and be used for a commercial fishery. And a genetic cousin of the one that I was working with is the, I believe it's close to the top, if not the top, like cultured scallop in Japan. And so this would be a potential species for competition. With that particular species, and in theory they could be exported to other countries or just sold domestically as well. So from there I ended up at my PhD. So sorry that was so long.
No, but wait, it's fine. But pause here for a second. So obviously you had a bunch of steps before you got to your PhD. Mm-hmm. When you mentioned before that you knew that, like, academia wasn't your, like, end goal, is that what motivated you to get a master's instead of a PhD at that point?
Well, so I actually, while I was at Haverford, I actually did contact a number of different people in sort of the marine resources field, and the vast majority of them were like, you don't have a master's. So what I've learned is that...
Oh, I see.
Most of the people in my field, especially coming straight out of undergrad, usually get a master's before they are accepted into a PhD program. That's not at all like the hard and fast rule, but the vast majority of people at least start as a master's student and then either transition or they get a master's and then move on to their PhD. There are exceptions to the rule, but I was basically told by most of the people that I contacted, like, oh, you need to get a master's first.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there you go. There's a plug for asking the right questions at the right time, right? Mm-hmm. Because that could definitely mess with your plans. So you did know you wanted to get a PhD. At what point in undergrad did you think you wanted to get a PhD? Was it like day one?
No, it was probably, I think, in the same experience that I was like, academia isn't for me. Mm-hmm. I also sort of figured out, because I'm fairly introspective compared to most people, so like I sort of simultaneously realized like, hey, academia isn't for me, but I was also realizing that the people who were doing the things that I wanted to do eventually mostly had PhDs. They either had PhDs or they had 20 to 30 years of experience. And I was like, I'm going to take the short road. So I knew pretty quickly, or not pretty quickly, but near the end of my college undergraduate career, I was pretty set on eventually getting a PhD. And luckily I have an advisor who supports that, the goal of not being in academia, but continuing with my PhD. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. We'll get to that in a second. So, okay. So you wrap up with your master's and then you go to Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like? Just out of curiosity. Like,
oh, I love Alaska.
Is there like a culture shock or anything?
Well, so the two previous summers, I'd actually worked there in the Bristol Bay salmon fishery. So I don't know if you've heard of the Pebble Mine, but there was this...
No, you're good.
That was the closest thing I can think of that might direct you to where it is. But so the Bristol Bay salmon fishery provides almost 50% of all of the salmon in the world. So 50% of the salmon that goes to market comes from, I think it's technically like 49%, but it is the largest salmon fishery in the world. There's nothing to compare to it. And they come up with millions of pounds of salmon over the course of about 4 weeks. And so I worked in the salmon fishery as like a quality control person for two consecutive summers. So, and I had also had the fortune of hiking up there, one summer as well. So I had visited Alaska before. As much as you can know what you're getting into based on those experiences, I at least had some context as to what I was going to be getting myself into to a certain extent. So, I really enjoyed it. I don't necessarily see myself living there long term in the future, but Alaska will always have a place in my heart, so to speak, because it is just, there is nothing like it anywhere else in the world. And I also love the mountains. So between my love of the ocean and my passion and career of like protecting and conserving our natural resources in the ocean, having that next to these gigantic mountains that I love to hike and backpack in was a great place for me. So
very cool.
Yeah.
So all of that salmon is collected in 4 weeks, you said?
4 to 6 weeks, but it's a fairly short amount of time.
Yeah, that's kind of shocking to me, but I mean, not that I've spent a lot of time thinking about that, but that just feels like so productive and efficient. But then, like, is there a lot of other overhead that like outside of that period?
So what do you mean by that exactly?
Like, if all of the salmon are collected in those 6 weeks, then is there like a bunch of work to be done after that?
So the way it works is, or at least my understanding of it is that the actual fishing boats basically stay on the water for those 6 weeks, let's say. They collect the salmon during openers and closers, or openings and closings, whatever. Openers is usually the bit of time that the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has opened the fishery. So they have people upriver, because the salmon come back to spawn upriver. They have people upriver that are basically counting the fish, and there are a certain number of fish for every single river that have to get beyond a certain point before the Alaska Department of Fish and Game open the fishery. And so once those fish have gotten past that certain point, they'll open it for a certain number of hours and they'll close it again. So they'll use their nets, they'll haul the fish aboard, and they will go to tenders, which are much larger vessels. So actually a lot of the vessels that I worked on, as the tenders for this particular fishery are on Deadliest Catch, or were on. I don't even know if the show's still running. But so I ended up working with a couple of captains from, and on a couple of boats from the Deadliest Catch. And so smaller fishing boats basically take their fish to these larger vessels, and these larger vessels end up taking them back to be basically fish processing plants. And depending on the grade of the fish, they're either like filleted and fresh, flash frozen, or they are put into cans and tinned and sold. So depending on basically the quality of the fish, that's what happens to the fish.
One more question about this, and then we'll move on. So there's a risk there if 49% of the world's salmon comes from that. If there's a risk that if there something happened to the environment there, that all of that could be messed with, right?
Yep. So this gets back to the Pebble Mine that I mentioned at the beginning. That particular mine, I believe it's a copper mine, is for the most part finally killed recently. But that particular copper mine was proposed at the headwaters of this fishery. In sort of pristine tundra, basically, that would feed every single river, or the vast majority of the rivers, to this super abundant fishery that brings in millions, if not billions of dollars, not only to the state of Alaska, but to the U.S.
The country, yeah.
Yeah. So, and of course they were like, all these protections, and there's only like this extremely small like percentage of risk that we, the like dams on our basically giant toxic waste reservoirs might fail and blah blah blah, but it's like, okay, well, if it fails, like the entire fishery is gone. And
so there is some analysis of risk, like that people are thinking about it sort of.
The Alaska in general is a really interesting fisheries state because there has to be a lot of coordination between the federal government and the state government, because the state government there manages a ton of different fisheries because it is so large. And so I don't know how many, this is not common knowledge necessarily, but states in general, manage fisheries and various maritime laws for the most part up to their state waters, which I believe, I don't remember right now, but they manage the state waters, which is like, it's either 9 or 12 miles. I can't remember off the top of my head right now. Then that's really bad, but they
in size,
in, what'd you say?
In size. That's like, that's the qualification, is the size of it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Nine, so like, 12, what? It's like, it's that many miles offshore. And so you can imagine that, especially for a fishery such as the salmon, that most of that is happening within sight of land. Not most. It all. It is all happening within sight of land. And you could probably, if the waters weren't rough, swim to shore. It's like really not far. It is all happening within state waters. And so they have to really manage this fishery really well. But then you have these huge, like, pollock fisheries and the Deadliest Catch fisheries, which I think was it snow crab, king crab? I can't remember. I've never watched the show. I just know that it existed. And people were very happy with
you
it.
You lived it.
Well, not really, but I lived with the people who did it. So, yeah. So there's a lot of, if you talk to enough, like, marine resources, particularly fisheries people, they will often have some connection to Alaska or some connection to the Gulf of Mexico. They've either done research with people who focus on stuff from either of those places, but Alaska particularly is, like, a pretty big fisheries place. Like, the amount of fish as well as money that comes out of Alaska is at least one order of magnitude larger than anywhere else in the U.S.
Wow, that's crazy.
So, yeah, when it comes to fisheries, Alaska is extremely important.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a good motto for today. No, just kidding. Let's keep going. So, you started your PhD.
Yep.
And when did you start your PhD?
I started my PhD in August of 2019. I was like one of the last classes, if not the last class, to start your PhD before the pandemic was a thing.
So, yeah. So going in, did most people have a master's?
I think every single person in my lab who was a PhD student had a master's. Most of the other people that I know that were there when I arrived either had a master's or had like 6 to 8 years of work experience between their bachelor's and their PhD.
Because of that, is there like a, you know, like I haven't interviewed anyone in your field yet, so this is interesting to me, because I think a lot of the people that I talk to, you know, it's like you come in and it's generally on average a 5-year program for a PhD, but if you come in with a master's, it could be like 3 or 4, depending on how efficient you are. What was your experience like?
So I am lucky enough that unlucky, however you look at it, I don't have any field work. also don't have any lab work technically. And so it was mainly focused on like, how quickly can I get this stuff done? I will graduate almost exactly, I think technically I'll graduate with like a few days shy of 4 years. Nice. So yeah, but I was also brought on for a particular project. As with some people, I would imagine in other fields are as well. They're brought on with particular like set of projects or at least a outline of like what they might be doing. But I was brought on to specifically work with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, which is the basically fish management agency in Florida, also known as FWC. So if I refer to them as FWC, it's the fish management agency. So okay. I was brought on specifically to work with them and to develop a strategic stocking plan for the entire state of Florida. So they don't technically have one yet. And so we've drafted it. I have to get it done in the next few weeks. And so we can get final sort of edits, before I graduate. But I was specifically brought on to work with FWC. My three chapters, in working with them are, the first one is a survey that went out to a little less than 250,000 anglers to ask them about their fishing and stocking preferences, specifically how they feel about stocking, or stocking of specific species. And stocking is basically you grow fish, or shellfish, but in this case, finfish, in a hatchery, and then you go and put them into other different water bodies. And so you would grow largemouth bass, for example, because that's one of the most popular fish in Florida, freshwater-wise. It is the most popular freshwater fish. You grow largemouth bass in a hatchery, and then you go and put those fish into a lake or a stream or some other water body. And so those are there for either anglers to catch if they're large enough or to potentially supplement the wild population. It could be to reintroduce a pen that was destroyed by, basically, a fish kill that was destroyed by a hurricane. So if a storm went through and completely, like, wiped out a population, they might use stocking to try to reintroduce it. So back to what I was saying, my first chapter was basically, like, what do the anglers want? What do they like? My second chapter, I developed basically a stock enhancement population model. So, basically a theoretical model where we have a landscape with population center and a bunch of different lakes that have, we use largemouth bass in this particular case because we have a fair amount of biological data on the life, what we call in our field life history. We have a lot of life history data, so like how long do they live, how quickly do they grow, what is their natural mortality, so if we're not fishing, how many of these fish die? And so I was able to build that model and say, okay, if we choose to stock this lake, or this lake, what does that do to angler satisfaction? What does that do to angler effort, which is basically how many people are going to be fishing that lake? What does that do to the wild population? All of those things. So we were able to look at a bunch of different management relevant metrics, because obviously managers want anglers to be happy, but they also, there's also some trade-off in like, we don't want to completely destroy the wild population that exists. And so we were able to look at different management metrics there. And then my last part of my PhD, or part of my dissertation rather, was optimizing the use of the hatchery. So hatcheries in Florida, but but this can be applied throughout the US, if not the world. We only have a set amount of space in these hatcheries. How on earth are we going to fit and balance the angler preferences with all of the other preferences and values that managers might have? So they might be worried about this population that got destroyed by the hurricane, but anglers just want to see largemouth, big largemouth bass in a completely different lake. So how do we manage that in, and how do we put all of that information into optimizing the use of particular hatcheries, of a particular set amount of hatchery space? And so I developed an optimization model to put all of that information in to basically the model, and you can run it and it will basically kick out the optimized outputs based on a set of values. And then you can balance the values of anglers versus managers a certain way for a particular year. And that those outputs may change. So using all of those, and each of those can be used or can be part of a suite of decision analysis or decision science tools to be applied to this particular stocking process. So obviously it's very tuned to the Florida stocking process, but my thought in going into this PhD and doing that was to really develop skills that could be applied more broadly to other natural resource challenges. Because ultimately my goal in my career is to try and find solutions, if not paths forward, for challenging natural resource management issues. So like my first love is the ocean. My second love, which is weird to say, is climate change. We're all going to have to adapt to climate change one way or another, whether we're prepared for it or not. And in the management of these natural resources, we need to be able to apply sometimes a very challenging set of values, whether it's stakeholders or managers, to really decide, is it worth it to try and save this population? Do we need to do this to make anglers happy? Or is it more worth our time to try and identify ecosystem needs that we can supplement? And so my goal with this dissertation was to really showcase a variety of skills that I could then apply to different management or different natural resource challenges moving forward.
Okay, very cool. I have many questions.
Okay.
So my first question is there a prediction component to this model? You know what I mean?
Not, so the last one, yes. Well, so not like, it's not a prediction necessarily. The idea behind this this set of tools was to more as a decision support tool than a, we're going to make the decision for you, because ultimately, regardless of what other like decision-making process that you might put into a model, there ultimately does still need to be a human making the decision. Yeah. And there needs to be some human judgment.
Hear that, ChatGPT? There's that for you.
I listened to the one from, I think it was last week or a while ago now, where ChatGPT came up, and I was like, apparently two professors, my advisor and then one other professor, were like convinced that they had gotten some papers that were written by ChatGPT, and they were like, what is going on? This makes no sense.
I have a friend who's a TA, and her she's a grad student TA, and her advisor was like, I need you to run these questions through ChatGPT before you grade them, because then you can like know what would happen if they did that, you know. So this is this like, I don't know, safeguards they're putting in.
Yeah, so
anyway, I digress.
You're good.
So okay, so that's cool. So what are you using to develop these tools? Is there like computer science involved?
So obviously the survey was like human dimensions. So like my degree is technically in interdisciplinary ecology. So my degree was supposed to be, and I'm very happy with it, very interdisciplinary. So my first one was a survey. It ended up involving some Bayesian statistics that somebody helped me develop a model for. So that was not necessarily computer science, but it's a bunch of programming, basically. And so the model that I've developed is basically a little bit, I guess, technically computer science. And I told my advisor this, I was like, I have no experience with programming. Like, I can do basic statistics in R. That is it. And so, yeah, so I basically came into my PhD with zero experience doing any of the things that I'm going to be presenting in less than a month.
So you learned them.
Yeah, so I learned them. So I don't know. So the last two are definitely computer science or computer science focused. If you had asked me that at Haverford, I would have been like, ha, that's funny. So my last two are definitely much more computer science heavy. It's especially the second one is all programming, math. How does math describe our natural world and putting that into code, basically.
Which is kind of cool.
Yeah, it is cool.
Once you get over the whole, like, computer science thing.
Well, see, the thing is, I love math, but the translating it into code sometimes hurts my brain.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, so my whole family is like computer science people, and I never got it. Like, I can't do it. And I always felt bad about that. And then because I like math, right? Mm-hmm. Same thing. Like, I love math. Math's great. I read an article recently that said that there's this like misconception that if you're good at math, you should be a software engineer.
Yeah.
But really, software development is like a language. It's like,
oh no, it 100% is.
If you can learn languages, that means you're probably going to be a better developer because you're communicating with a computer. It's like so I'm not good at learning languages. So now I feel validated.
Oh, 100%. So my sister knows 5 or 6 languages and three or four of them pretty fluently. Oh no, I did not get that gene. I struggle. My joke is that I struggle with English. I struggle with one language. I don't need to try and learn another. I knew French and I knew Latin at one point. Now I sort of know computer programming, but yeah, no, it's 100% another language and it's hard to put in my brain. So
yeah, good. Well,
you should 100%
that's good.
Feel
I feel
validated.
Even more validated that you feel the same way as I do. Another question is, this is more specific, but you had, you talked about the stocked fish that you, in the hatchery, and then you put them in the natural environment. Is there a difference between them and like the wild fish as far as like size or like?
So Technically, yes. And a lot of it comes from, not a lot, but a large portion of it comes from the fact that they are raised in the hatchery. They don't have the mortality associated with random predators eating a certain set of eggs. They don't have the mortality of, I don't know, a hurricane coming through and like pushing some of them off onto the shore so they shrivel up. Like, there isn't that mortality associated with them. They also don't have to survive other predators eating the, what we call fingerlings. So just basically, if you can, literally a fingerling is the size of your finger. And so there isn't that set of factors affecting the population. And the fish having to hide from predators, the fish having to find their own food. So there are plenty of studies out there about conditioning hatchery fish for a week to a month or whatever being stocked into the natural world. So that is one pretty big component. Also, in the real world, you would have a bunch of different broods, what we call brood stock, which would be the fish that basically mix to actually create the eggs. In the hatchery, it's like set of pairs. And so you wouldn't necessarily have the natural mixing of those traits. And the other part of, and this goes back to the, like, the natural mortality, what are the factors that are affecting wild hatchlings versus hatchery, is that this is the survival of the fittest part. Like, if a fish can't figure out how to hide from a predator, it's not going to make it too far in the wild. Oh. But if there are no predators in the hatchery and they're just plopped into a pond or a lake, they're going to be there. And if they magically happen to survive, and this is this is much more relevant to fish that are larger. If they're put in as fingerlings, this has less of an impact. But if you're going to be growing what we would call derby-sized fish, so like large enough fish to catch, in theory, they're closer to the size at which they would contribute to spawning. And they would then potentially bring those traits that allowed them to maybe be successful in the hatchery, but not as successful in the wild, and they contribute that to the population. So those are some other concerns as well.
So the dumb fish start to reproduce.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, last question is, what of this... So first of all, this is super cool because I feel like, you know, I've heard about a lot of people's dissertations, and this feels very impact right away type topical. But how much of this did you publish, or will you publish? And like,
well, hopefully all of it. My survey chapter is basically ready to go. I gave the like last call to all our authors a couple weeks ago, being like, get your last minute comments, like, gonna try and submit it in the next week or so. So that one, hopefully I will have submitted before I defend. So like in the next couple weeks. And the idea is the, hopefully the other two chapters I will get submitted before I graduate in August. So ideally all of it, that's the hope. I also, there are a couple of super management relevant questions from that survey that I did not focus on for like the paper / my chapter. And that is basically, we asked them the impact of particular stocking choices on their choice of how frequently they fish and their choice to purchase a license. Those are two super management relevant questions. Like, if we do this, will you fish more or will you fish less? Is it positive, negative? And then the other one is like, will you continue to buy a license? Like, for FWC, the vast majority of their revenue comes from license purchases.
Yeah.
And so
you need to know that your decisions will affect that in what way.
Exactly. So yeah. I would really like to potentially write a paper based on those two questions, but it's much more based on behavioral human dimensions, and that's not what I particularly focused on for this, for my survey chapter that I decided to write. So still needs to be written. Cool. I think it would be really cool to write. But yeah, the idea is that all of these would be published. So
that's cool. And also, if published, is it open access?
Yes. So my advisor and I want to make sure that all of this research is open access. We generally in our lab make sure that when we publish it is open access.
That seems like a good decision because
I don't understand. It's also really annoying because if you publish open access, then you have to like pay more. And
yes,
I have feelings, but it's okay.
Yeah. Well, you can come back on the show. We'll talk about paywalls. And we'll just complain about it because it's hurting the development of science in this country.
It really is. Yeah.
Okay. Well, this is great. Let me check my questions. Okay. So you're almost done. Mm-hmm. You're defending in a month?
Yes. Just less.
Less than a month?
Just less than a month.
That's great. You're going to be fine. So what is your job search like right now?
It's really hard to be like finishing up your dissertation and simultaneously looking for jobs, especially with like less than a month to go before your defense. And so I tried to sort of work ahead, and there are particular fellowships that I have applied for. I'm just waiting to hear back from one, which would be my first choice. It's the Knaus Marine Policy Fellowship. It would be based in DC, and you would be placed either with like a NOAA office or basically marine related office, or you would end up working with a particular, like you'd be on staff for a representative or a senator, or be part of staff for a particular committee. And so I'm hoping to hear back from them like early mid-June-ish. And so that would be like my first choice, but that wouldn't start until February. So luckily one of my committee members let me know that he has enough funding for 9 months of a postdoc. So I could work with him from September until when the fellowship starts. Or if for some reason the fellowship doesn't come through, I can basically work for him for 9 months or however long before, while I'm applying to jobs and hopefully submitting my dissertation chapters as well. So
yeah, it's really tough. I think, you know, there's plenty of examples where people find where they luck out in the sense that somebody has funding for them to do this like intermediate postdoc, or even like delay submission of, I guess at Drexel for us, we were allowed to like defend and then stick around for another quarter while we look for jobs and like write papers or something. But you know, and so there's some labs I've heard that want you to find a job first and then they'll like let you leave, but that's stressful too, because then the jobs are like, what do you mean you're not done? You know, it's just like, God, what chaos. I don't know.
Yeah, so me neither. I hopefully the fellowship comes through and then I don't have to worry too much. Of course, it's like a 1-year fellowship, so as soon as you get there, you're going to start applying.
You're going to apply for jobs. Yeah.
But the nice thing is that because I would like to probably work in government or work in some sort of like advocacy / lobbying potentially. Having that 6 months of postdoc and then starting the fellowship, I can start applying to jobs for like having 1 year of experience. Because I wouldn't start really applying to jobs until like 6 months in. So I would have like 6 months left of the fellowship. And at that point I would have basically a year of experience. And a lot of the USA jobs, GS or ZP levels, you need like 1 year of experience after your PhD to like get the next level up, which would help long term, obviously. So
and you'll also probably make contacts when you're in DC, like to continue that type of work.
Yeah,
which is cool. once you're in DC. I think you're gonna get it.
Yep. That's the hope. I'm like a little optimistic right now, but we'll it changes week to week.
And you're from DC, right?
Yeah, I grew up outside DC. So never in a million years would I have thought that I would have been like, yeah, DC, but here I am. So
hey, you've been around a little bit. Like, yeah. It's okay to go home now.
Also, like, I would love to live in Seattle, but that's a whole nother thing. So I really like
you're in Florida right now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So very different, Florida and Seattle.
Oh, quite.
Okay, so I'm going to move to my wrap-up questions, but first I want to know, what are some interesting things about you? Do you have time outside of your PhD to do things like hobbies? It's okay if you don't, but...
Well, I did, except for maybe the last few months. I've been a little bit focused on wrapping everything up, but I mentioned this, I really love to hike. I have a dog and we both really, really enjoy being outside. So, when I was not living in the land of pancake Florida, I would love to hike mountains. And because in Florida, it's basically like, let's go for a walk. So I haven't done a ton of hiking here. However, yeah. I have learned to love the natural springs in Florida. And so a bunch of friends would, or just a smaller group of friends, we would always go to the springs every now and then on the weekends. So that was really nice. I also like really love landscape photography. That's been a passion of mine for a while. And so I really love like sunsets and sunrises, sunsets and sunrises. So finding good places around here to get some nice photos. Just being outside is really important to me, and for me it's a mental health thing too, and I think it's really, really important for people in PhD programs to sort of figure out if you really, really don't want to do like therapy. I think everybody in a PhD program should go see a therapist every now and then, because like it's just naturally a lot of stress, but if you don't want to do that, like figure out what your therapy is. Like, for me, it was a lot of spending time outside, sunset, sunrises, spending out time outside. And for me, going to the gym was also really important. Like, yes. I've been an athlete my entire life. Did lacrosse at Haverford. Like, that has never left. Every single place I've ever lived, I've either played lacrosse, I played ice hockey in Alaska, and soccer. I've played soccer here for the last 3 years. Like, I have found different sports to do. But
because you can't turn it off.
You can't turn it off. It's just important, and it doesn't have to be sports. It can be like I learned to throw pottery last fall, and I really enjoyed it. So just finding those things that allow your brain to turn off and to really sort of let your body actually relax and think about other things. So those are my hobbies, but also like that's, I guess, a bit of advice for anybody who's either thinking about or in a PhD program is to really figure out, and it doesn't have to be a huge amount of time. Like obviously playing a whole soccer game is a lot of time. And if you don't feel like you have that, that's fine. But like figuring out what your sort of non-work thing is. I think that's really important to force yourself to have a little bit of balance, because especially in a PhD program, it can be so all consuming sometimes. So,
yeah, for sure. Yeah. My recent therapy is to do paint by numbers.
Nice. Looks great.
Yeah. It's very calming, because it's productive, but it's not, there's no pressure. Like,
well, exactly. And there doesn't need to be any pressure, so.
Yeah, there's plenty of pressure in your PhD program, right?
Precisely. So yeah.
Okay, great. So I don't want to keep you for too long, but are you good to answer my three wrap-up questions?
Yes.
Okay. Can you tell me something challenging or surprising that you faced at some point in your PhD?
Um not entirely surprising, but challenging was really learning the coding that would go into. It's a pretty steep learning curve, but I had a lot of support from the people in my lab to learn and ask questions of. And but honestly, I'm like really proud of myself for learning as much as I have. There's plenty more for me to learn, but I would not have felt as confident as I do now without that support. So
yeah, that's a good one. And was it sort of like it was this like major part of your project that you weren't necessarily going into that field, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
But you did it.
Yeah, but I did it, and I learned things, and it's pretty good if I do say so myself, so.
There you go. Take credit. Okay, what advice would you give to yourself from your first year? Advice to yourself in your first year. That's my question.
So the first, like, actionable item, I would say, is set up Google Alerts for particular terms.
Publications.
Yeah, for publications on, like, I think it's Google Scholar. You might be able to do it on some other, those types of websites. But specifically, I'm thinking of Google Scholar. That way, you can at least see titles that come in, either every day or however frequently you want to set them up. Definitely wish I did that. But my other piece of advice, and I think this can apply to any point in your dissertation or in your research, is, like, sometimes there will be parts of your dissertation and your research that you just really don't want to do and you're not excited about, but you really need to figure out what is that one part that gets you really excited and that will get you through. Like, at various points, I was like, oh, I really want to understand the answer to this particular question on my survey, or I want to see how, if I adjust the scenario in this model and I decide to stock here, what does that mean for the wild population or the angler movement? Or if I decide that I only want angler preferences to go into my optimization, what does that result in? And so finding that one thing that will help you get through, because there will be times when you're just like, I don't want to do this anymore. This is not interesting. Like, I don't care if you find somebody who says that they loved it all the time. I would be shocked. I would, like, no. There are going to be moments where you're just like, I'm done. And when those moments come, it's just important to figure out whether it's the broader impacts of your research or a particular aspect or a particular result that you're really interested in to continue going. So those are my two pieces of advice. Google Scholar alerts and finding that particular part of your research that you're really interested in and that will help you get through that particular hurdle.
That's great. Love that advice. Okay, lastly, do you have a good memory or story from your time as a PhD student that you'd like to share?
I don't really. It's hard because it's like most of my research / PhD was during COVID.
Oh, true.
And so it was like, I, especially before COVID, it was really nice to basically hang out with our lab because our lab was really close. And so it was really nice to hang out with them on weekends and at social events. And we all had a really good time. And so before that, it was just like, it was the people. And more recently, my advisor and one other student, we all went to Australia in February for an international conference. So
that's going, a good one.
Yeah, going to Australia was pretty neat. So, yeah. So I'd say people for sure. Like, my lab was really great. And then going to Australia is definitely it's a gold star.
Yeah. So always worth looking for those conferences that are in fun places, right?
Definitely.
All right. Well, that are all my questions. Anything else you want to plug? Your open access papers that people should read?
I don't unfortunately have any published quite yet, but will be.
Well, they will be.
They will be very soon. But I, yeah, most of them will be on like Florida stocking and Florida angler preferences and things like that. So, if you're ever interested, sounds in a great. Few months, maybe next year, you can Google Scholar my name plus like largemouth bass or stocking and something will come up. So,
well, thanks for your time. And thanks for coming on the show. And, it was very cool. It's very nice of you to give us your time in this crazy month of wrapping up. So,
of course, anytime.
Thanks for coming on. It was great.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to Diana for coming on the show. If you or someone you know wants to be interviewed on Impact Factor, feel free to reach out via Instagram and follow us for updates at Impact Factor Pod. Thank you all for listening and have a great week.